Here It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Calling all space enthusiasts, set your alarms for the overnight hours and look up. A total lunar eclipse is set for Wisconsin skies.
The celestial event returns to align the Earth, Moon, and Sun for a pretty cool sight.
Once the Moon passes the Earth's shadow, a beautiful range of red and orange colors will form as the blood moon takes effect.
As Wisconsinites hope for clear skies, we're learning more about the rare event. The leader of the Northwoods Explorers of Space and Astronomy, based in Minocqua, is with us. Jim Head is the president of the group. He's also a NASA JPL Solar System Ambassador. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for the invite. Appreciate it and broadcasting this.
And now, assuming we get clear enough skies, we'll talk about that in a bit, I think. What do we see when we have this full lunar eclipse?
Well, tonight, the moon eclipse begins at 11 p.m., ends around 5 a.m. However, totality is when you can see it best is from 1:26 a.m. to 2:31 for about 66 minutes. It'll be located just south of the constellation Leo in the south direction. It glows between Regulus, Leo's bright star, and Virgo's brightest star, Spica. The moon is roundest on the day when it's full, but the day before and after it appears almost, but not quite full. Tonight's full moon is called the Worm Moon. The name Worm Moon honors the stirring of earthworms and insect larvae in the slowly warming late winter and early spring soil. They occur fairly frequently, with at least two happening every year somewhere on Earth. On average, there are about three lunar eclipses annually, but not all of them are total lunar eclipses, and not all of them are the same location. If the same location, it happens about once every 2.5 years. Of course, it always depends on the alignment of the sun, Earth, and moon, with the Earth being in the middle, with the Earth, the moon traveling into its shadow as we go around the sun together as a system. It'll appear red due to the phenomenon called Rayleigh scattering. That's because the blue, the faster rays, the blue and purples and one end of the spectrum get scattered. The red light, just like on a sunset or sunrise, goes through our atmosphere and lights up the moon when it's in our shadow. So it's not totally dark. And if you use binoculars or a telescope, you can see more detail, but just having your own eyes up there is fine. And if there's a few clouds, it should be bright enough to see through them.
Okay. And looking at the weather, I was peeking around the state. It looks like partly cloudy through a lot of the southern parts of the state, mostly cloudy in northern part, I think, including in your neck of the woods. But you're thinking it'll be bright enough, even if you have pretty good cloud cover, you're going to see something?
Yeah, I think so. Yes.
Now, as somebody who likes to watch the night sky, obviously, give us a sense of how exciting a lunar eclipse is for you. Is this mundane every couple of few years, or is this something you're definitely going to sacrifice some sleep for?
Well, I think it's really worth it. I mean, it's quite a unique phenomena. We're the only planet in the solar system that can have a total solar eclipses because the moon's apparent size almost matches the sun, some 90 million more miles away from the moon and us. And a lunar eclipse is just as exciting. Now, they don't happen every time during a full moon because our moon's orbit is tilted 5 degrees to the plane of our orbit around the sun. So it has to be lined up perfectly with the plane, and that only happens a few times during the year. So this is a special event. The next one's not until March 3rd next year at 2:44 a.m. And the next one after that's another year and a half away. So they're pretty rare. Now, the partial lunar eclipses happen more often, but to have one in totality is a real treat. And to see it red like this is really unique. And if you have, like I said, binoculars, just standard binoculars, just rest them against your brow, sit down, look to the south, and I bet you'll see some really interesting craters and details. It's just a fascinating to see. And plus, if you were on the moon looking at the Earth, you'd be able to see a sunrise and sunset everywhere on Earth while this is happening.
I guess, yeah, from the perspective of the moon, this is a solar eclipse, or I guess an earthal eclipse. The sun is going to be completely blocked out if one of us happens to be standing on the moon looking inward.
Yeah, but you see a ring of fire around planet Earth. So
amazing. Now, the moon is entirely in Earth's shadow. And I will admit, I'm kind of a fan of lunar eclipses. I like to get out and watch them. I've suffered through some pretty cold weather to watch them. And it is... it's kind of mind-blowing to think the moon, which is a pretty big thing up there, is in the Earth's shadow. Does that just a unique perspective on our night sky when this happens?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the last time it happened here at my home here in Minocqua, my porch faces the south. It was 30 degrees below at 1 o'clock in the morning. My wife and I went out and saw it. We didn't last very long, but it was interesting to see the cold weather at the same time, the crisp blood moon. It was just a fascinating sight. I hope the same thing will happen tonight, except the warmer temperatures, of course.
Right. And now you're part of this Northwood Explorers of Space and Astronomy. Is this something that you and other people are gathering to watch together, or are you kind of all in touch beforehand, you know, making your plans, but you'll kind of do it from separate locations?
Let's do it from separate locations. We have over 400 people on our email list. We give out Aurora alerts, and everybody else is free to sign up. You can just go to our website at thenorthwoodsexplorers.org. We also have information on our homepage about this eclipse. You also can go to timeanddate.com for all eclipses in the future, both total and lunar. So it's really a good thing to see. We hold public stargazing parties and other events. If it's during the daytime, we can do it, but it's kind of hard to set up for everybody to see in the morning. Plus, you don't need a telescope. We have some really fantastic telescopes to share the universe with the public and schools and public libraries. But all our events are listed on our homepage. And if you have an astronomy club near you, I'm sure they're going to be having events too. I know there's some really good ones in Madison and Milwaukee. Some of their members are members of our club. I'm a member of some of their clubs. So we all kind of work together. There's over 600 astronomy clubs across the United States. Almost all of them are nonprofit like we are. And we just serve to help educate the public and make them more aware of the beautiful universe that's around us.
We're talking about the total lunar eclipse coming to Wisconsin skies after midnight tonight. Jim Head is with us, president of the Northwoods Explorers of Space and Astronomy, based in Minocqua. Now, a fun coincidence here, Jim, is tomorrow is March 14th, a.k.a. Pi Day, because of the mathematical ratio pi, 3.14, etc. And that's a fun number for astronomers, because a lot of astronomy happens in circles, right? Why is pi so significant?
Well, with pi, all you need is to look at the moon, calculate its diameter, and you can determine its circumference and its volume. Furthermore, if you study it a little bit farther over a period of a year, you can figure out Earth's orbital period, and any other planet orbital period. And it's used in many other ways, of course, and it's just a really handy formula to use if you're trying to figure out something.
Including orbits, the circumference of planets. Talk about the significance of pi. How do we use that in our math to do some homebrewed astronomy?
Well, if you want to find out the mass of the moon, for example, you'd have to find out the volume of the moon and its orbital period and approximate mass that it's orbiting. So you can do it in that way. Many other ways you use it is just to figure out the angular diameter of an object so you can set up your camera right so you can frame it correctly in the field of view when you're doing astrophotography.
I want to look at some other events going on in the night sky. Now, I've seen headlines. I haven't gone out and tried to see it, but a planetary lineup where a bunch of our solar system neighbors have been present in the night sky at the same time. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Well, they're not really lined up only from our apparent view. If you were to go out into space, you'd see they're in different locations. Of course, some are nearer to us, some are farther away. Venus and Mercury are inner planets to us, so they are only visible shortly after sunset or before sunrise. It's pretty unique when you have the moon grazing a planet or a star. We call that an occultation. That's a fun object to watch because you can look at the actual shape of the mountains on the limb of the sun as the star blinks in and out as it's just grazing it. That's very interesting. There's many other events coming up. We just had an amazing total solar eclipse last year. The next good one in North America is not going to happen until 2045. But every night, like the spring is best for looking at galaxies because our perspective and how we're arranged in our solar system to the Milky Way is kind of out of the way on the horizon. So it opens up the rest of the universe. If you want to do any deep sky viewing with galaxies through a telescope, spring is the best time to do that. For planet viewing, winter is usually the best if you think about it, because in the summer, the sun's high. That means at night, planets will be low because we all are in the same plane called the ecliptic. In the wintertime, it's just the opposite. The sun is down low and the planets will be up high. Unfortunately, Jupiter and Saturn are marching forward right now in the sky. Like you said, you can see many planets, but Orion's up. You can see Jupiter, Saturn, Mars, Venus. So it's quite a treat.
All right, now galaxy watching. I know occasionally we could see them. I don't know from a galaxy. It might just look like a little cluster of stars to me. What kind of galaxies can we take a gander at in the spring?
Well, there's thousands to choose from, but you'll need a telescope. The only galaxy visible by your unaided eye is Andromeda, M31, or Messier 31. And that's visible in the summertime and in the fall. And it's larger than the moon. So we, at our star parties, we use green lasers that seem like they point for miles to point to the laser, to the galaxy, because it's difficult to pick out just by yourself, and then have a person with a set of binoculars follow the end of my laser. Then I turn my laser off and kapow, the galaxy is right in their view. And it looks pretty good. Now, you can't see individual stars in a distant galaxy. They just look like blurbs. It wasn't until the early 1900s that they even discovered there were other galaxies beside the Milky Way galaxy. And they thought they were just nebula, little nebulous things, because they look all fuzzy, because you can't resolve the stars. I mean, the Andromeda galaxy is 2.5 million light years away. And the other galaxy that I'm speaking about in the spring, they're 10 to 20 to 30 to 100 million light years away. So the fact that the Andromeda, our neighbor, is only 2.5 million light years away allows us to see it. Now, we're on a collision course, the Milky Way galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy, and we'll merge, and that'll be quite a sight, but that won't be for another 5 billion years.
Yeah, I won't set my clock for that one. But the mind-blowing thing here for me is you're talking only 2.5 million light years away. Light year, that's the distance that a beam of light would travel in a year. So when I'm looking at Andromeda, say, I'm actually seeing Andromeda as it looked 2.5 million years ago, because it took the light that long to get here. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's right.
Now, are there other big events that you and your club mates are looking forward to over the course of the summer?
Well, we're not proponents of daylight savings time. It's hard to have star parties for children and everybody else in June when it doesn't get dark until 10:30.
Fair.
So what we do in the summertime is that we have solar telescopes that are called hydrogen alpha. They're a special frequency at the red end of the spectrum that allow you to look at the sun's chromosphere. This is the layer that's below the photosphere. The bright white light, yellow light that we see right now is from the photosphere. Below that is the chromosphere, and the chromosphere are hydrogen atoms cooling down, and they map all the features of the magnetic waves and the plasma in the sun.
Wow.
You can see the sun bubbling through our telescope. You can see prominences on the limb of the sun.
And I'll have to jump in there. Happy watching tonight. Hope you don't have a lot of clouds. That's Jim Head with the Northwoods Explorers of Space and Astronomy in Minocqua talking about tonight's full lunar eclipse.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a new documentary looks into UW's two-year colleges that closed and the impact on local communities when campuses went dark.
People just say, oh, well, nobody wanted to go to these colleges, or, oh, well, enrollment is down and you got to cut spending because it's wasteful. I don't buy it.
The film is called Closure. That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A new documentary looks at the closure of two-year campuses within the universities of Wisconsin system.
The UW-Platteville-Richland campus will close entirely next year.
UW-Green Bay is suspending in-person instruction this fall at its Marinette campus.
And also ending in-person classes for UW-Milwaukee's Washington County campus, that's in West Bend, and UW-Oshkosh's Fond du Lac campus.
The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee announced today that its Waukesha campus will close in spring of 2025.
Gathering 75 hours of footage, Ken Broski documented two campuses as they were closing. It's called Closure, the Dismantling of Wisconsin's Colleges, and it recently screened at the Door County Film Fest. Ken Broski is an associate professor in the College of Integrated Studies on the UW-Whitewater at Rock County campus. Ken, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You teach English literature and creative writing. What made you decide to pick up a camera for this project rather than write about it?
I was very profoundly affected by the news last spring that UW-Waukesha was going to be closing. And that's because it was always seen as the sort of one of the crown jewels of the two-year UW colleges. And for it to close was just so shocking to me. I wanted to start digging into what was going on. And so I started asking around with former colleagues, and I got in touch with a couple who wanted to talk about the closures that were happening. And from there, it kind of just snowballed. And I realized if I wanted to actually document this and you know, dig deep into what was going on, I was going to have to rent a camera and try and figure it out, right? And so I ultimately ended up begging for money on Kickstarter and got a couple thousand dollars, enough to, you know, pay for hard drives and rent the equipment. And then I basically spent pretty much all of last year putting together the documentary.
I was struck how you called UW-Waukesha the crown jewel of the UW colleges. What made it so special?
UW-Waukesha, it is not in a place where enrollment should be going down. It's in a very, very, very fast-growing county. And the very fact that it plummeted at UW-Waukesha should be talked about more. It's not a natural occurrence. It can't be explained by additional classes at the local tech school. It can't be explained by high school enrollments, which are very healthy in that part of the state. It really is, there's something else going on. And what it all goes back to, like with many of the other two-year college campuses, is the massive amount of budget cuts that hit the universities of Wisconsin under Scott Walker. And those budget cuts basically made it very, very difficult for the two-year colleges to go out and recruit students from local high schools. It made it more difficult for community outreach to happen because those budget cuts were so devastating. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is the two-year colleges, you know, a lot of what they do well is they go out and they find students who weren't necessarily thinking about college and giving them a place, an affordable place where they can start and sort of take the pressure off that you might find at a giant university where sometimes, you know, freshmen are put into classes with 200 other freshmen. And that was kind of what makes the UW colleges to this day so special, the two-year campuses that are still open. And UW-Waukesha really, I mean, it really emphasized that. They had all sorts of community commitments. They were such a tremendous part of the Waukesha community. And for the enrollment to plummet, it was just so shocking to me that I really wanted to dig deeper and try to help us understand what's going on a little bit better.
And you call these two-year schools affordable and loved. How did these campuses, or how are these campuses, the ones that remain open, embrace the local community and really create this tight bond with the area?
Well, I think it's easy for people who maybe have never been a part of it to sort of feel like there's nothing going on. But in reality, what happens at these campuses is you have communities coming to concerts. You have local communities that utilize the space. So, for example, on the Rock campus in Janesville, we're going to have a theater production, a high school theater production, take place in our theater on campus. So they're using it as a resource. We have a music professor on our campus who, you know, he has tons of community members who are in his band that plays publicly and, you know, does that kind of stuff. You know, and then of course there's the research. For example, we have a scientist on our campus he's a mayfly expert. He does a ton of research on mayflies in Wisconsin. And, you know, all of that stuff, when you add it all together, the planetariums, the museums, there's a planetarium and a museum that's going to be part of the closure at the UW Fox Cities campus. Those are all places that the community uses. Those are all places that the community relies on. To say nothing of the fact that a lot of the work we do on campus with students specifically, we get a lot of students who are at a high risk of dropping out. They need a lot of support, right? And we rely on, for example, we use federal grants to create programs that focus specifically on those students. And, you know, these are not students who necessarily have two parents who have been in college. These are not necessarily students who are who have like really affordable or even know where they're going to be sleeping one specific night. They might be partially homeless to some degree and sort of moving around a lot. And for all of these students, they're just the resources that we can offer because of the work we do with grant funding and because of the small classes. All of that sort of builds community in the places where these are located. You know, UW Richland had a campus that was very vibrant and it closed. It was one of the first to be closed. Richland County is one of the poorest counties in Wisconsin. And to lose that campus has been so economically devastating. And to this day, I don't really fully know what is going to happen to those future generations of high school students in Richland County who could, you know, just a couple of years ago could go attend a two-year campus, get all of their gen eds done over the next 2 years at an incredibly affordable price. I don't know where they're going to go. Like, I don't know. It feels like we don't have a plan for those students, and it makes me very angry.
I want to pause there on UW-Richland because I was struck by the interview you had as Marnie Dresser cleans out her office, teaching there since the early 90s. And I want to listen to one of the stories she told you.
One of my really promising creative writing students didn't know if she wanted to go past her associate degree. She said, well, I would love to go to Madison, but I can't. I just couldn't. It's too scary. I'm like, well, what's scary about it? And so she would tell me what was scary about it. And she was such a talented writer. I said, you know what? How about I drive us to Madison and I take you to where you would take creative writing classes and introduce you to one of their professors is a friend of mine, their director of undergraduate creative writing, and just say hi. So once she saw, you know, you figure out where you're going to park, and then you walk to the building, and then once you're inside the building, it's the scale that she was used to. So she was fine. And they were happy to welcome her. She went there, she got her degree.
That story, I just couldn't believe the investment by that professor to help make that a reality. Did you hear stories like that as you went along making the documentary?
Oh, yeah. This is normal. This is absolutely normal for the faculty that were essentially let go at these campuses. They do this all the time, you know. And I don't know how to quantify this for people who are looking for like a spreadsheet, you know, cost-benefit analysis of these campuses. But for a lot of professors and a lot of faculty and even part-time teachers on these campuses, this was the norm. You know, and just to be clear, like when I started teaching at the two-year colleges as a faculty member, I was making $43,000 a year. I was making less than an assistant manager at Quick Trip. And I was doing those things too. This is a normal thing we do. I'm going to be taking one of my students to a basketball game in a couple of weeks because she wants to write about basketball. And I said, well, you know, you want to be on the team? Let's go write about it, right? We do this kind of stuff. And because we treat education like a business, right, because we're obsessed with enrollment numbers and how much money the campus is, quote unquote, losing, we can't really, it's very hard to defend keeping these campuses open because how do we quantify that kind of outreach? Who knows what that student is going to do? All the students that we help, you know, outside of our normal job duties, like we can't really do that. And so what happens is, in the media, and especially on social media, people just say, oh, well, nobody wanted to go to these colleges, or, oh, well, enrollment is down and you got to cut spending because it's wasteful. But I don't know. Is it really wasteful? I don't buy it. I don't believe that.
We're talking with Ken Broski, associate professor at UW-Whitewater Rock County campus. His new documentary film is called Closure. It follows the closure of UW-Richland and UW-Washington County last year and what the loss of two-year campuses means for rural communities around the state. Ken, in 2017, you show in the documentary there's this seat change under the direction of the UW Board of Regents and the UW president. Two-year colleges merge with four-year universities. They're called branch campuses now. But what do you see was problematic about that move?
I think for a lot of four-year universities, they just did not understand the two-year campus's mission of affordability and access. I'm in a really lucky spot. UW-Whitewater was, their leadership has been fantastic, and they've been very, very involved in understanding what it is we do on the Rock campus in Janesville. But from what I've got from other, from, you know, colleagues, it just seems like a lot of the other four-year universities just would not make that same effort. And the two-year campuses suffered. There was a very big enrollment drop after the merger took place. And this would be, this was the second enrollment drop that happened. The first enrollment drop happened after the massive budget cuts under Scott Walker, where all of the campuses had to basically, they had to basically shed about 20% of their budgets and not raise tuition. And so there was this double dip, right? This double recession of enrollment. And one of the things that's been shocking to me is, like, when I talk to some colleagues from these campuses that have closed, the things that could have been done differently is, you know, is really amazing to me. Like, for example, UW-Platteville, I was talking to people in the documentary who were on the county board for Richland, and they found funding to have a recruitment officer for the UW-Richland campus that they were going to pay for that wouldn't be a part of UW-Platteville's budget. And Platteville told them no. And the fact that the university turned down a recruitment officer who could have gone out and recruited students for UW-Richland is such a, like, I hope at somewhere we are learning from that mistake. I just don't see it right now. And it's one of the things that kind of drives me crazy is, if we make mistakes, that's fine, but we should be learning from them so we can preserve what's still left. We should not be closing any more campuses.
On the theme of the lack of recruitment and marketing, let's listen to Sean Murphy-Lopez, who previously served on the Richland County Board. Let's take a listen.
What was happening at UW-Richland is they had staff going out into the local high schools. They would actually meet the kids and ask them to come. And they would encourage kids who weren't necessarily college material. They said, you're capable of this. Come to this campus because this campus has very personal one-on-one attention. You have small class sizes. Plus, look where it's located. Then I would meet people and they would say, or they would write letters and they'd say, I would have never gone to college had it not been for that person reaching out to me and telling me I could do it.
It sounds like it was more than just recruitment happening here. It was going out and saying, look, student, you are capable of college. Can you talk about that distinction?
So I've been doing a lot of retention research recently, and one of the things I keep seeing in survey after survey of students is we always ask them, well, why don't you take advantage of professors' office hours, right? Why don't you go out and look for your professor to ask questions? And the number one answer in all of these surveys and all of this research is the student thinks they're stupid, right? And so that mindset is the mindset that we are constantly challenging in the two-year campus space. And so when we go out and we actually reach out to students and we tell them that there is a place for them to get an affordable start to college, we have to remember that a lot of these students have spent their entire education basically being told that they're a specific level of intelligent, right? They take a test, they get a grade. They take a standardized test, they get a score. And these metrics, I think a lot of students internalize these metrics as basically, well, this is how smart I am. And so what we do, what we are really good at doing, and the Rock campus is great at this, and the other campuses are great at this too, is we are really great at reaching out to those students and basically saying, that is not who you are. You are capable of more. Let us help you with the next step, right? And that's kind of the magic of the Wisconsin idea, which is this notion, you know, this kind of radical notion that everybody in Wisconsin deserves access to higher education, right? It's not just for the students who in their junior year are like, I'm going to apply to UW-Madison, right? It's for every high school student. And so that's one of the main things that makes the UW colleges, the two-year campuses, so special.
What happens to this documentary next?
I'm going to put it up on YouTube. So if people want to search for it, they can just search for closure, the dismantling of Wisconsin's colleges. We're going to do a showing in Platteville in a couple of weeks. We're going to do a showing in Stevens Point in a couple of weeks. I'm still waiting to hear from the Milwaukee Film Festival, although, you know, to be fair, I only had a $3,000 budget, so that might be a bit of a stretch. But beyond that, I've been putting together a spreadsheet of people from the UW Waukesha and the UW Fox Valley campuses who want to talk and maybe do some smaller segments on YouTube for people to watch, and just continue documenting these closures in the hopes that we can maybe push back a little bit. I think one of the things people need to remember is, you know, it wouldn't take a lot of money to save these campuses and to make them, you know, and to make them thrive. You know, you just need to have the state support behind it. You need to have that apparatus to recruit and go out and build that community. And I think the Universities of Wisconsin does a pretty darn good job of all this. I think, you know, in general, we've overall done a pretty good job of, you know, responding to the budget cuts and the animosity towards higher education. I think we need to continually learn from our mistakes, and we need to put more support behind this. And we need to recognize that education is not a business. It's just not. It's education, and we should treat it like that.
Ken, thank you for sharing closure with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Ken Broski is an associate professor at UW-Whitewater at Rock County. We recently spoke about his new documentary called Closure, The Dismantling of Wisconsin's Colleges. It will screen this evening in Platteville and in Stevens Point on April 8th. It's available to watch on YouTube. And for disclosure, WPR is a service of UW-Madison.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, in Williams Bay, a charity event is taking off with over 100,000 balloons on display.
We're lucky. We love our jobs. So when we get to do it on this scale, it's so fun. It's a lot of work, but it's so fun.
A balloon artist behind the scenes at Balloon Adventure. That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. On the shores of Lake Geneva, over 100,000 balloons are on display in Williams Bay this week as part of the charity Balloon Adventure event.
It's a fundraiser put on by a local nonprofit, with this year's proceeds benefiting a youth summer camp in the area.
More than a dozen balloon artists contributed to the displays and activities centered around a theme, Voyage into the Deep Sea.
Sarah Meyer is owner of Wisconsin Balloon Decor in Lake Geneva and led the team of balloon artists. Sarah, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much.
And Kimberly Voller is here, executive director of the 531 Fund. It's a nonprofit that supports local charities in southern Wisconsin. Kimberly, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Kimberly, let's start with you. When someone walks into the balloon adventure, what do they see? Can you paint a picture for us?
Oh, so when they walk in, the first thing they see is balloons. So you walk in the front door and immediately you are faced with balloons. And those balloons take you down through, down a staircase and into our beautiful display that Sarah has put together for us.
Okay, and so what are some of the themes in the balloons? What are they depicting?
So the theme this year is Voyage into the Deep Sea, and so everything is under the sea. So it's very cool, because when you walk in, you immediately see like water waves kind of thing taking you down the stairs, and once you get downstairs, it's like you're in the ocean. So then you start seeing some different like fish and coral and different things like that.
Are these balloons close enough to touch, or do you keep them away?
So they are, you are walking through the actual balloons, so they are close enough that you can touch. However, we are trying to keep little fingers off of them if we can to preserve them for the time period that we're open. The one thing that we did this year is we actually give the kids a balloon and are telling them this is their egg that they need to protect as they go through the ocean. And then once they get through the ocean to the other side, they're able to pop the balloon and then they get a cute little stuffed animal that's in there.
From one mom to another, that is brilliant. That works.
Thank you.
Okay, Sarah, when you're putting together a balloon display at this scale and as intricate as this, where do you begin?
Well, first the theme, and then I start with a Pinterest board. I get the ideas, and I kind of know how I want it to feel. So last year it was very light and open, and this year we wanted it very dark and enclosed. So I kind of had that feeling of tunnels and little nooks and caves and dark blues. And then it kind of slowly comes into focus over the course of about a year. So we start with big picture, and then I kind of narrowed it down to areas. So I wanted, obviously, like the animals and the sea creatures, but then I wanted a neon section, and then I wanted jellyfish, and then we wanted a pirate ship, and then mermaids and dolphins. And I kind of divided up into different sections, and then each of those sections breaks down into components and then recipes all the way down into how many balloons I actually need to order. So it gets down to the, you know, individual balloon eventually, so that when the team gets here, we know where to start. And then we kind of start at the very beginning and go all the way up to the big concept. So it's quite a long process, but one balloon at a time, honestly.
I love how you say recipes, because these designs, I can imagine, you know, section by section, maybe the geometry involved or how you fit together so many different colors and types of balloons. That must be quite the process.
It is. It is. Some of the things we really can't plan. I mean, some of the, like, the sculptures of the people, like we have mermaids and scuba divers, those we bring in artists to kind of build on the fly. That's their specialty. Other things like the walls, I mean, it really is like building a wall, and it's multiplication. And if you need, you know, four balloons every square foot, you can multiply it times height times width, you know, goes all the way back to grade school. And it really is just multiplication and making sure that you have enough material to cover the surfaces and framework. And it's a lot of work, but we have 4 days to pull it off. So it all has to be done in advance.
I'm going to remind my fifth graders, this is what you can do with your multiplication tables.
Yeah. Some of the jobs you can get. Yeah.
Living and breathing multiplication. Kimberly, this is the second annual balloon adventure. How did it go last year, and what's different for you in year two?
All right. So last year we did Wizard of Oz, and it was an incredible display and people loved it. It was ironic because we had a lot of people that were Wizard of Oz fans. And so they were coming from all over to see it. So that was really great. The community, you know, obviously they were very supportive and attended the event. And going into year two, it's like you have a little more knowledge of what to expect and what to plan for and whatever, as far as that goes. But you still can't, like, you still have things that you got to figure out because the display is different. It's set up differently. So you got to kind of figure out how you're going to make it all flow and work well so that everybody, you know, all the attendees have a good time.
Sarah, how long does it take to inflate and construct 100,000 balloons?
Yeah, so we had a team of 15 artists, and it took us 4 days, pretty much nonstop. So it's a lot of man hours, but I mean, not that long when you actually see the impact. You know, it would take me weeks and months to get it completely done. It's like one person just cannot do it on their own, which is why the spots on the team are pretty coveted. It's pretty fun to be part of this group, because not many people get to work alongside their friends and do something on this scale. A lot of times we're decorating corporate events or birthday parties, and you know what we can do with our individual businesses is one thing, but what you can do when you bring 15 companies and experts together and what we can accomplish in 4 days, it really is amazing.
How do you learn to become an expert in the twisting and the tying and the inflating and the designing? What are the artistic skills that you really have to hone?
Well, personally, you know, everyone has their own story of how they found balloons. I was an art teacher, so my background is in art. And I think the education side really comes in handy with the planning and the prep and how to break things down step by step. So that's kind of my background. And from being an art teacher, I worked at a college. I worked at Carroll University for a long time and did balloons on the side and then eventually went full time in my business. But a lot of other decorators have backgrounds as, you know, cake decorators or magicians, or like we all just kind of found our way. But I think the common trend is that we're all really creative. We're all pretty laid back and can kind of think on the fly and troubleshoot. That's the biggest thing. Something always goes wrong. This year I got sick. I missed an entire day and the team had to do it without me. So it's like even the best laid plan, something will go wrong. And you just need a team that can kind of roll with the punches.
We're talking about the Balloon Adventure charity event this week in Williams Bay, and we have Sarah Meyer there, business owner, Wisconsin Balloon Decor, and the creative lead of this event. And we also have Executive Director Kimberly Voller, who leads 531 Fund. Kimberly, can you talk about why a balloon event as a fundraising venture for the 531 Fund? What is going to be what you'll be able to do with this?
So the 531 Fund is a charity that supports other charities in our community along the state line of Wisconsin. So the charity that we chose this year as a board and as the executive director, we chose a local charity called Camp Timberley, which is located in East Troy. It's a summer camp for kids. And I really feel that, you know, the balloon